Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orange and Brown Talk podcast on Cleveland.com. I am Dan Lobby, and joining me via phone is Mary Kay Cabot and Scott Patsko. Guys, how are you?
I'm doing great. Just fresh off the fresh home from the Senior Bowl today, so doing great.
All right, so we are
coming home to lovely, warm Ohio.
Yeah, right, all that snow. So anyway, let's get to this. We wanted to record a podcast because, of course, today a big piece dropped by Seth Wickersham of ESPN, all about kind of inside the Browns and a lot of the dysfunction that has kind of led to where they are now, or at least kind of where they were coming into this season before they got Baker Mayfield, before John Dorsey had really kind of sunk his claws into this organization. And we're going to get into a few takeaways from that piece that's up at ESPN. And let's just start here because I think the big overarching topic is, of course, Jimmy Haslam. And, Mary Kay, I'll start with you. We've kind of known, everybody has kind of known that Jimmy Haslam has had some issues. He hasn't been real decisive. He hasn't really been able to find that stability that he wanted when he first came here from Pittsburgh. So not a lot of surprises necessarily in that sense, but this certainly put a lot of things out in the light for people to see about Jimmy.
Yeah, you know what? I think that what it did was it really provided a lot of really insider detail. Like, we knew most of these things happened. I mean, I really chronicled the whole Ray Farmer thing and broke the Techgate story and all of those sorts of things. You know, we knew that Jimmy was the one that wanted Johnny Manziel. So I think, it really was a deeper dive into a lot of things that, a lot of stories that we already knew, some extra little insight and details just into the background of all of the dysfunction that we have basically known about since Jimmy purchased the team.
Scott, when you kind of first sat down and read this piece, what was your takeaway kind of from the Jimmy Haslam, the Haslam element of it all?
I think it seemed to reinforce a lot of the things that people thought about Haslam's anyways. There was a sense that he got too involved. You know, we'd heard all about Johnny Manziel and how that pick came down and his impatience with different regimes and how quick he's been to change his mind. And I think this kind of laid that out. One thing to keep in mind, this is written for a national publication. I believe that this is going in ESPN, the magazine as well. So it's a national audience. It's not really for the Cleveland audience. So it's informing a lot of people who haven't been here and living through it for the past however many years. So there's that element to it. So as you read it from the Cleveland perspective, you're like, okay, well, we kind of knew that. And there was a point where it just felt like it was kind of rehashing things. But it did give a sense of what some of those behind-the-scenes meetings were like. So in that respect, there was some good nuggets in there. But I think overall, it just kind of reinforced what we already thought.
Yeah, and just really the processes that were kind of laid out, the way that Ray Farmer sort of took over for Joe Banner when that all went down, kind of how things went down after that as well, kind of inside a little bit of the Sashi Brown stuff, which is still obviously a fresh wound for a lot of people. It just seemed like, Jimmy was very flavor of the month, Mary Kay. He never really could land on one group of people that he really trusted.
Yeah, and that has been a recurring theme since Jimmy and Dee agreed to purchase his team in 2012, that they have kind of listened to the last person, maybe listened to too many people, tried too hard to do things in a radically different way. But for the most part, one of the things that I have felt all along is they've made sort of obvious, glaring mistakes. I mean, you cannot put an all analytics front office together and leave out that very important element of talent evaluation. To me, that's just an obvious, glaring omission in your organizational structure. And then he puts, before that, puts Ray Farmer in place as the general manager. Nobody thought that was a good idea, even though apparently the Dolphins were thinking about hiring him. Sometimes some of that stuff is gamesmanship. Now, maybe they would have hired him as their GM, but it seems so far-fetched to me that anybody would really be thinking of Ray Farmer who again was like 39 years old at the time and had no experience and was not ready for that kind of a role, to all of a sudden be named the general manager of the team. I mean, there have just been things along the way that are so puzzling, and I think that's the one of the things that stood out to me.
Yeah, Scott, that going back to that Ray Farmer era, kind of the way he ended up there, and then really to sort of have his first draft, that first round sort of torpedoed. He picks Justin Gilbert from Mike Pettine, and of course we know there were a lot of really good players at the top of that draft, and then ends up picking Johnny Manziel. There's the whole handshake thing with Teddy Bridgewater, who knows about that, but it really was really a very symbolic kind of era for the Haslam ownership, I think.
Yeah, I found myself as I was reading this trying to keep track of the people he said did not talk to him. I'm talking about Wickersham here, trying to figure out how he went about putting the story together. Obviously, there's no way Jimmy Haslam's going to come off looking too good in a story that has a lot of sources that are basically former employees who were probably fired by the Haslams. He's fired a lot of people. And I'm wondering, like, trying to go through and figure, do you think he talked to Pettine? Do you think he talked to, I mean, Banner, obviously, he talked to, because I think he quoted him at one point. And trying to get a sense of who the sources are to kind of piece together, because everybody's got their different point of view on how things have gone down there. We've, even after the Hugh Jackson firing, and he goes out on his mini media tour and kind of gives his side of the story, which is different than what we were hearing from other people. So that was kind of another takeaway for me, is trying to figure out who he talked to and maybe how that person became a source.
Well, I think in these sorts of situations, and I know just from my own experience, everybody starts to assume that you talk to this person or you talk to that person, or it's obvious that you spoke with this person. But it's not always as obvious as people seem to think it is. I just spent some time at the Senior Bowl. People come up and tell me things, and I have conversations with people that tell me things that happened inside the Browns building, that they know of those things because one of those people in the building is like one of their best friends, and they told them. So, you don't always get things directly from maybe the person who was fired, although I suspect that there were plenty of people who have been fired by Jimmy Haslam who spoke to Seth Wickersham for this article. There was a lot of like really good insider nuggets in there that I think probably only some people that were there at the time could have told him. But again, it's not always so cut and dry. People close to the people who these things happen to are quite often very willing to talk.
But before we get into the takeaways, I do have to ask, have either of you ever shorthanded dog pound as DP?
No.
I have not. I don't know that many people have. That was one of them. Yeah, we're not going to spend a lot of time on that, but that was certainly a standout moment from the article. Okay, so let's get to it, because we each sort of had a takeaway from this story. And so we'll start with you, Mary Kay. What was kind of a big takeaway from you?
I would have to say that one of the things that really struck me and stood out was the fact that Sashi Brown and Paul DePodesta were so vehemently opposed to the hiring of Hugh Jackson. And I think that does inform just how much of a disaster those 2 years were. They were an absolute disaster from minute one. It all started to go downhill after we saw Hugh Jackson walk into the building and to that great thunderous applause and that, that little hallway foyer speech and all of that. I mean, that was the best that it was. And it started to go downhill very, very quickly after that. And I think the fact that those guys actually went to Jimmy Haslam and said, do not do this, that part really stood out to me. And the fact that that it was 4-1. Now, we had heard before through Jason Lockhamfor, I believe, that Sean McDermott was the favorite of the analytics guys of Paul and Sashi. But here it was 4-1 with Jimmy being the lone Hugh Jackson supporter. I mean, how do you do that? How do you go out on a limb and do that when your top trusted aides are so opposed to it. And that is just setting yourself up for disaster right from the start.
Yeah, if you're going to buy into this plan, if you're going to adopt this plan that Sashi Brown and company wanted to go after, why would you go against their recommendation for head coach? That's completely bizarre. And kind of the crazy thing about it is Sean McDermott, of course, ended up in Buffalo, and they've taken a little bit, not quite as extreme as the Browns approach, but they've taken a little bit of that same approach. So you can see how that fit probably would have been a better fit. I don't know if it would change anything. I don't know if it would have worked, but he certainly would have been a better fit than Hugh Jackson ended up being, especially with the way it came about.
Well, I mean, if you consider the way some of the draft worked out, I mean, let's say, for instance, that they had hired Sean McDermott. That changes the course of the draft for the next 2 years, which, of course, then changes everything about the Cleveland Browns right now. Because, obviously, they probably wouldn't have Baker Mayfield. I don't think they would. They probably would not have drafted Myles Garrett, number one overall. In that year, in the second year. So, I really don't think that, who knows if they would have even traded down away from Carson Wentz. So there's so many different things that would have been different, I think, if they had hired Sean McDermott.
Scott, I mean, just kind of your thoughts on that whole 4-1, Jimmy, the one in that equation goes out and hires his guy.
That was kind of surprising because it seemed like at that point they were kind of on the same page, and he seemed willing to move forward with that idea, and everybody's kind of has the same plan. And yeah, I was kind of shocked by that. I don't think we'd really heard that before. So yeah, that was quite shocking.
Yeah, and it kind of gave us a look into why, you know, that dysfunction, you know, we knew about that dysfunction there. It kind of gave us a look into why it was there. So, Scott, what was your sort of takeaway from this that maybe we haven't touched on?
You know, it was towards the end of the story where they're going over the period where Sashi Brown was fired. And there's a quote from Dee. And it cites multiple sources hearing it, where she says, "We just don't know what we're doing. If we'd known how hard it would be, we never would have bought the team." And I have a hard time believing that somebody who's running the Browns or running any company would say that in front of their employees or people who work for them. Maybe it's something she said in confidence with Jimmy. Maybe it's something she said in confidence with, I don't know, somebody who's close to the family or close to them. But that seems kind of, that's not something you want to say in an office around people who are working for you and who are counting on you to make the right decisions, you know?
Yeah. You know what? Some of the direct quotes, again, if you are getting some of this information from, and we know that Dee and Jimmy did not talk to Seth for this article. So you're getting someone else that is quoting her as saying that. So maybe some of it gets a little bit changed in this, you know, maybe there's a word here or there that gets lost in the translation. Maybe it's a little bit different. I do have a little bit of a hard time hearing Dee say exactly those words. Like you said, she's a very smart and savvy businesswoman. And, you know, I don't know that she would be speaking like that, to her employees. I'm sure there was some version of that, but quite like that, you know, I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah, it's a little bit of game of telephone when you get into this stuff, especially if you don't get, you know, a direct comment from the person who said it or, you know, confirm it with them that happened. It becomes a little bit of a game of telephone. But I think the bigger overarching piece of that is, you know, all these meetings that they had to, you know, here's our next head coach, here's our next regime change, here's, you know, you can see how that can wear on them when it's just failure after failure.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, it's shocking to me, and I wrote about this along the way, you know, several times about how they weren't setting things up properly, and you know how you can't you know, just have that void in the front office and different things along the way. I mean, they made really big mistakes. I mean, they made really big mistakes along the way. And I don't know why they didn't have some really good trusted advisors early on in the process that could help them avoid some of these mistakes. And I don't know, it's just mind-boggling that you can get it wrong so many times. And another thing that I've written about extensively and I've talked about is I just don't think that you can keep holdovers from the previous regimes and try to blend them with the new. I just, you know, you have to be very, very careful when you do that. So even when, you know, Sashi and Paul and those guys took over, it was really still, you know, the holdovers from the previous regime. Instead of, you know, just kind of starting fresh and saying, you know, new coach, new front office, here we go. You know, they just kept trying to patch together people that didn't fit together.
Okay, so that's actually a nice little leadway, I think, into what I'm going to put out there as my takeaway, and it's sort of how we've gotten to where we are now with Freddie Kitchens as the head coach, John Dorsey as the GM. You know, Mary Kay, you have reported that Freddie Kitchens will report to John Dorsey. You know, Dorsey didn't want to just come out and say it at his press conference, but, you know, it seems like the structure is a little better now. And I guess the thing that stood out to me is, in the very end of this, John Dorsey seems like a very strong figure. You know, Sashi Brown, Ray Farmer, all of these guys. You know, obviously Joe Banner came here with a strong background, but things were just kind of a mess there to begin with. But Dorsey is kind of the one guy that's come here with some cachet, and he was kind of brought in to rescue this thing. And it does seem like the fact that he's got a little power, that they had so much success initially, it seems like he's got some cachet to wield right now, and maybe kind of keep ownership in check, at least at the moment. I think that's my sort of takeaway from all of this. Maybe I'm just being optimistic here, but I think that's sort of my takeaway.
Well, I think you're right. And I think, you know, it's another one of those situations where Jimmy has decided that he has found the right man to lead this organization to the next level. And put a lot of, there's a power shift going on right now. With Freddie Kitchens reporting directly to John Dorsey, as you mentioned, you know, that represents a shift in the power structure of the organization. That means that John Dorsey probably won the coaching search, and he also won the right to have jurisdiction over Freddie Kitchens. And that is a paradigm shift in this organization. It hasn't been that way before, and there has been a lot of internal strife with the way things have been set up. So I do think that this is a step in the right direction. And I also think that the press conference was a sign that Jimmy's trying to, you know, stay in the background a little bit and let John Dorsey do his thing. So I think that was important. Although I also think that I would have had Jimmy up there with those guys at the table, because it sort of had a feel to it like, wait, Jimmy, are you like really excited about this? Are you happy about this? I think he should have been up there talking about Freddie, supporting Freddie, and chiming in and saying, you know, that this was all unanimous and we're all happy and we're all going in the same direction.
Yeah, Scott, that was something you brought up the day of the press conference. The mm-hmm. idea that Jimmy was not up there, that he was not a front-facing piece of this. And, you know, he really was, even kind of when the press conference was going on, when they went up to take pictures after. There wasn't a whole lot of Jimmy. He was just very low key through everything.
Yeah, I think, and I thought a little bit more about that afterwards. And, you know, he had the quote, I think him and Dee had a combined or shared quote maybe, or statement when the email first went out that they, you know, were maybe a hiring official. But I think maybe he wanted to avoid having to talk about all the mistakes he's made in the past, because you know that would have been a line of questioning at some point. And perhaps he just wanted to have the focus be on the potential good decision that they just made, and let Dorsey and Kitchens kind of talk about the future. I think if Haslam had been up there, there would have been a lot of rehashing the things that we read about in the story.
Yeah, I think, you know, look, this story is going to ultimately in the annals of Brown's history be looked at one of two ways. It's either going to be a precursor to why maybe this doesn't work, or it's going to be just sort of a piece of history if Baker Mayfield and John Dorsey and Freddie Kitchens can really turn this team into a contender. And, you know, yeah, I think the fact that they have Baker Mayfield, that they have John Dorsey, that they have things kind of pointed in the right direction, I got the sense from Browns fans that this piece didn't really sting as much as it might have if, you know, this team had gone 3-13 and maybe they weren't feeling as good about their quarterback.
Yeah, and because you know what? Go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say, it's because you have a GM who's done it before, and you have a quarterback who everybody thinks is the franchise quarterback. That takes all the sting out of it.
Yeah, and I think Dorsey has so much cred right now. He's got so much credibility because of the Baker Mayfield pick and because of Nick Chubb and Denzel Ward and the way he turned the team around basically in short order, that, you know, he can almost do no wrong right now. And I think that, you know, that's why they're willing to give him this power and trust that he can get the job done and take this team where they want to go, which is obviously to the Super Bowl ultimately. And I think they feel like they can do that. So, you know, right now it really looks like, you know, that Jimmy and Dee have struck gold with the combo they have going.
All right. So that'll do it for this edition of the Orange and Brown Talk podcast. Of course, we're sponsored by Sibling Revelry Brewing. Our thanks to them. Thanks to Mary Kay and Scott for jumping on here. Mary Kay, of course, back from Mobile just today. So appreciate both of you guys taking the time to get this thing recorded here today so everybody could have it in their podcast feeds on Friday and over the weekend. Of course, any place you subscribe to podcasts, that's where you can find the Orange and Brown Talk podcast. Thanks to all of you for listening. For Scott Patzko, Mary Kay Cabot, I'm Dan Lobby. Thanks for listening, everybody.